I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Fujiko Aoki, who is the chef and owner of Mochirin, which is a unique Japanese-style sweet shop in New York City. And traditional Japanese sweets are called wagashi, which has distinctive characters. And a recent article in the New York Times Tea Magazine, issued on August 14th, summarizes it. And the title of the article is Sweets as Poignant as Poetry. One writer considers wagashi, Japanese tea ceremony treats, as bittersweet pleasure for stressful times. And by the way, Fujiko is featured in this article, of course. So, and I really like the opening of the article, which starts as, "River of heaven, young grass waiting on the snow, wind in the distance." Each phrase is the name of the piece of wagashi, Japanese sweets made to accompany the traditional tea ceremony. If they sound like lines from a haiku, that's deliberate. The sweet, small, obsessively curated, installed to the seasons, share the same mission as haiku. To pluck out of the stream of time one beautiful fugitive moment and hold it still. That's wagashi. So today we'll discuss the essence of Japanese wagashi, Fujiko's unique artistic background to make her stunningly beautiful sweets, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. So please go to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now let's start our conversation with Fujiko Aoki. Hello, Fujiko. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you.
So, so first of all, where in Japan are you from?
I was born and raised in Kyoto, and later I lived and worked in Tokyo.
Mm, okay. Mm-hmm. And so I heard that you used to be in the publishing industry in Japan and working at El Japan. Mm-hmm. So what kind of work did you do?
Mm-hmm. After I graduated from college, I started working as an editor at a fashion industry magazine called WWD Japan. Mm. Then I was at a women's publication working mainly on stories about Japanese traditions, food, tableware, antique, travel, and so on. Mm. I then worked at El Japón, overseeing main features and interior design stories.
Mm, that's a massive responsibility.
Yeah, after that, I became a freelance editor, specializing in interior design, food, architecture, art, and just design in general, for magazines like Casa Brutas and Luca. I also edited cookbooks and essay collections.
Mm, okay. So that really makes sense that I heard that you published two cookbooks in Japan before you came to the States. So how did you get into cooking after working in the publishing industry?
How did I get into cooking? I've always loved eating and also recreating dishes that I'd tasted and enjoyed at restaurants. Mm. So I used to make everything at home, from simple side dishes to braised oxtail in red wine, and I even tried cooking soft-shell turtle and shark fin. Yeah. Professionally, it was as a writer for this magazine called Danchu, which at that time was considered the best gourmet magazine in Japan.
Mm, actually, Danchu means it's a cooking for men, like a men cooking in the kitchen,
yeah,
which is kind of unusual for mm-hmm. Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. So that was really a major yeah. publication.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that I first stepped into the cooking industry. At the time, I was still at WWD Japan, so I actually had to keep it a secret. Mm. Initially, I didn't even imagine that cooking would become my means of expression at all.
Mm.
But working alongside a number of chefs and food professionals, eventually I ended up writing cookbooks of my own.
Mm.
And then I started doing catering for photo shoots and parties because of my husband's work and the demands from my friends.
Mm. What does your husband do?
Photographer, still life.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Mm. Okay. So the two cookbooks, mm-hmm. First of all, you have one of them, Osowake, Ofukuwake, published in 2006. Mm-hmm. And I think the title itself is very intriguing. It's meaning sharing goodies and luck with others.
Mm-hmm.
So, why did you publish the book?
Yes, Osowake and Ofukuwake are both an old Japanese custom, you know. It's basically a practice of sharing food stuff with others back in the day. People used to bring food to their neighbors and friends to share with them, maybe some apples and tangerines that they received from their family back home or from acquaintances.
Mm.
Or desserts and snacks that they receive as gift, or just some extra food that they ended up making mm. that day.
Right. It's interesting that Japanese culture, it's such a gift-oriented culture. Mm-hmm. And then if something you receive, you want to share it with other people. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. kind of networking. Mm-hmm. Right.
So what I wanted to introduce in this book was the type of preserved foods that used to be, but are no longer being made at home these days. Traditional Japanese pickles like nukazuke, umeboshi, kasuzuke fish, or chimen sancho, sun-dried persimmon, karasumi, which is Japanese version of botaruga. Mm. I wanted to encourage people to make them at home again.
Mm, I actually never thought of making it. It's something to buy. You never think of making them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and to share with others and to try making new dishes with these foods.
Mm.
I used to make chirimen sancho, which is my hometown specialty from Kyoto, mm-hmm. for fun. And because you can make a lot of it at once.
Mm, so chirimen sancho, mm-hmm. basically, it's a white bite with like sancho pepper,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's the chimen sancho, and I think it's one of the most classic Kyoto mm-hmm. flavors,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay.
I would bring it to work and share it with my colleagues. So usually after sending out a new issue to the printer, our editorial room would suddenly turn into a chimen sancho distribution club. yeah. So, you know, these preserved foods are never fashionable and generally considered countrified.
Mm.
But what I noticed was that it stimulated open conversation about everyone's hometowns mm. and neighborhoods, which didn't happen much during work.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, you know, those are traditional foods. Chirimen sancho is one of them, but sancho, of course, is a little green pot mm-hmm. that's packed with citrus and mm-hmm. flavor, and mm-hmm. this kind of tongue-numbing mm-hmm. and yeah. tingle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very traditional Japanese flavor, and mm-hmm. we are really making it as coming back mm-hmm. because making by yourself, I think it tastes so much better than mm-hmm. buying from the store.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the essence of the book. Mm-hmm. And what about the book, Ochi de Tsukuru, Kyodo Gohan? It's published in 2009, and the title means regional cuisine cooked at home.
Ochi.
So, yeah. So, yeah, what is the theme of the book of the Ochi de Tsukuru, Kyodo Gohan?
Just like osusuwake, ofukuwake, the main theme was to take a fresh look at all traditions so that readers can rediscover the beauty and the charm of regional cuisine that are disappearing.
Okay, so I mean that you in the book you cover the whole country of Japan, featuring classic regional dishes from Hokkaido to Kyushu, from the north to south. So it must be really hard to compile a book. So yeah, so what did you want your audience to learn from the book?
That book is actually based on an essay series that I started in 2004. And around that time, Japan was seeing the rapid nuclearization of families. Especially in urban area, the foreign food culture and the habit of dining out were noticeably growing dominant. Even in rural area, the culture of regional cooking was disappearing. People just didn't cook regional dishes as much, and some recipes were starting to be completely forgotten. So I felt the need to write down these recipes that were previously passed down orally, and also the need to appreciate them from a new or at least modern perspective. The book introduces 57 recipes from 23 different prefectures in Japan, but it weaves in stories about local women, moms, and grandma who are known for their cooking. Stories about the particular region and the person behind each dish, the real-life social network, as well as the coexisting of human and nature, all contribute to shaping each regional cuisine. So think of the dish that you make while thinking about your mother or grandmother, or the dish that reminds you of festival and celebratory occasions, the dishes that have been passed on through local women's groups, or the dishes that make you ever more aware of the bounty that the sea and the mountain bring. Whichever the type of dish, regional cuisine is generally based on home-cooked meals, and it's deeply connected with women's life and lifestyle. Regional cuisine is also unique regionality and the type of humanity. As information becomes more and more saturated and homogenized with the internet and social media today, regional cuisine may be an ever more important factor to pay attention to in order for us people to not be homogenized.
I think actually it's happening here in New York City kind of globally because people started to pay attention to local ingredients and flavors. So yeah, I really wish the book is published in English too. It's such a beautiful book. Maybe you should try to make an English version.
Yeah, thank you.
So, okay. And so now let's talk about your life now. So when and why did you come to New York?
I moved to New York in November of 2010 for my photographer husband's job.
Okay. And I heard that you started your business in New York with a catering business. So what kind of catering business did you have?
At first, I was just preparing meals for my husband's clients who attended his shoots. From there, I started catering other photographers' shoots and fashion events. I also catered kaiseki meals at tea ceremonies. Most of what I made was Japanese food with New York twist. I guess I could say that it was sort of a regional cuisine as prepared by a Japanese person in New York.
So that's the continuation from your book and then your regional in terms of New York. Okay, so let's talk about your amazing business, Mochirin. And before that, I just wanted to quickly summarize for our audience who's not familiar with wagashi. The basic characteristics of wagashi are traditional Japanese confections. Wagashi are basically traditional Japanese confections made from seasonal plant-based ingredients such as beans, rice, kuzu powder, fruits, and sugar. And the kuzu powder, by the way, is like cornstarch, and it's really very essential for Japanese wagashi. So, and wagashi are often intended to be served at tea ceremonies, but of course, you can find so many wagashi shops in Japan, and people eat wagashi as regular sweets. And because of their delicate and beautiful nature, they are popular gift items as well. So, wagashi in general is pretty still quintessential Japanese and then popular, right? So, okay, so now, when and why did you open the wagashi shop in New York, which is called Mochirin?
Yeah. I used to make bite-sized sakura mochi for catering sometimes, and every time I did, I noticed that people really enjoyed them, and I received good feedback. So I thought maybe I could try giving traditional mochi sweets like daifuku and sakura mochi a new twist and create original New York flavors. And that led me to open Mochirin in the spring of 2015.
Okay, so basically, so that's the mochi is very specific, right? It's kind of gooey and chewy, right? So that's the reason you chose mochi as your theme of your business, because it was popular?
Much like pasta or bread or rice, udon noodle, and other carbohydrates, mochi should be versatile in terms of how they can be flavored. Yet somehow, mochi snacks didn't really evolve that much over the years. For example, the regular daifuku is too big for me, and I find the taste to be too monotonous. So unless I'm starving, I wouldn't be able to eat it. But I realized that by making some adjustments to the size or the flavor, I could make mochi snacks that I would actually want to eat even if I weren't hungry. At the heart of it, though, it's all about cooking. For my catering, I've studied and experimented with all kinds of flavor combinations to express something uniquely New York, and that I thought was delicious as a Japanese person. And I found mochi to be a perfect platform to concoct and deliver this fresh new flavor with.
Okay, yeah, so because basically mochi is a Japanese rice cake made of mochigome, short grain, japonica, like glutinous, like sticky rice. And like you said, it's kind of a white canvas because it can be just confectionery, like sweets, and typically, you know, classic mochi has a red bean paste inside, which is called anko. And it can be, of course, ice cream, which is like a modern version. And also you can have like a soup and a mochi in it. So it's such a diverse, versatile theme for you can just play with. So what is the meaning of a rin in mochirin?
There is an expression in Japanese, to be rin. The word rin expresses a certain poise, this crisp, elegant tension in composure or attitude. It's also used to describe a type of upright, gallant masculinity. But I chose the word to express that gracefully restrained composure. The state of being rin is perhaps like a surface of pure water that's elegantly still. One drop of water falls on it, and it would create these beautiful ripples across the water. Maybe I should say it's sort of a pure, upright, and open spirit. Now that I have been cooking professionally, if someone asks me what characterizes Japanese cuisine such as kaiseki, I think I would instinctively respond that it's the rin composure. Of course, these days, the plating style has become pretty westernized. The ingredient-focused cooking, that's simple but delicate, is distinctively different from the gorgeous dazzles and lavishness of Western cooking. I actually found that the characters in Ozu and Kurosawa films often show a rin spirit, which modern Japanese people are starting to forget. forget. And I wanted to express that very Japanese quality of being ring in my mochi confections in hopes to keep it alive.
Right. Yeah, so when I hear rin to suru means like your back is straight, but then you're not so assertive. Very, it's like I don't know, nice flower. Looks delicate, but very energetic at the same time. So, yeah, that's the spirit of your business. So what is the theme of mochirin?
I'd say it's to express New York's seasonality through these poised mochi desserts.
Let's take a quick break here because we have a lot to cover later. So when we come back, we'll talk about what kind of unique sweets Fujiko offers at the mochirin. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets. Next time you step up for the
intention. Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Fujiko Aoki, who is the chef and owner of Mochirin, which is a traditional as well as modern Japanese sweet shop based in New York City. So what kind of non-traditional Japanese elements do you incorporate into your mochi sweets?
So far, we've tried making them with prosciutto and melon, anise rose petals and other edible flowers, or like dill, cilantro, black pepper, white pepper, yuzu kosho, black cherry. Many kinds.
Right. Yeah. Well, actually, before the show, Fujiko brought two kinds of really tasty mochi sweets. And one of them, it's elderflower and watermelon, and it's the hidden salt flavor. And in Japan, people eat watermelon with a bit of salt. That's classic. And incorporate into that kind of delicate mochi, very smooth and clear. And then you have texture of mochi as well as fresh sweet watermelon. So it's really something far beyond regular classic wagashi. So I was very impressed. Okay, so you said prosciutto. And that kind of Western element.
Yes.
Right. So for you, is it okay? You feel comfortable?
Yes, very much.
Because you taste?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So maybe you can give us some examples of your signature mochi sweets.
So we have a raspberry and chocolate ganache mochi, which is raspberry, cream cheese, and chocolate ganache wrapped in the Marco Polo tea-flavored mochi skin. And dusted with cocoa powder. And the lemon and broccoli wave flour mochi, which has lemon-flavored white bean paste inside, the mochi skin made with domyoji powder and topped with salted wave flour.
So domyoji powder is the sweet sticky rice.
Yes.
And then dried and powdered. So it has a distinctive texture and flavor.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
So this are two signature kinds that I have been making since I started with a gradual refinement process.
Okay. So I'm sure there's going to be more signature. So your sweets are stunningly beautiful and delicate. And do you think your experience in the magazine business helped to create your artistic sweets?
Over the years, I've seen a lot of beautiful things that surround us in Japan, in New York, or elsewhere. Whether in the form of fashion or design, interior deco, you know, architecture, art, antique, or food. And I think these things have certainly helped for a certain aesthetic in me. But first and foremost, my focus as a magazine editor was always about looking at old beliefs and traditions, the values that tend to get outdated from a new angle, and giving them a fresh context or framework. So I feel what I've done in my editorial work and what I'm doing today with food are ultimately the same.
Right. And of course, you have technical experience, like photo shoot and imaging what's possible in the pictures and like how to shape. So, yeah, I think you are a pastry chef, but there's something in on top of it, so that's great. So, and I know that you emphasize seasonality on your menu, and your site explains it beautifully. So, could you explain the Japanese word shun?
Sure. So just like in New York, we have four distinct seasons in Japan, and there we have this very old custom that has been practiced since more than 1200 years ago of admiring this seasonality and weaving them into songs and poems. And that custom is practiced in traditional Japanese cooking and confectionery too. Each season has its own dishes and confections that appreciate and express the seasonality. In Japan, we have this word shun, which refers to the time of the year when a particular ingredient reaches its optimal deliciousness. There are three phases of shun. Hashiri is the first 10 days. Then comes shun, the 10 most prime days, followed by nagori, which is the last 10 days.
Right, so at least if you just divide four seasons times three, because there's three phrases, you have 12. And I think the world of Kaiseki, they say 24. So it's kind of moving target, and it's a beautiful Japanese wagashi as well as Japanese cuisine. Okay, and so what do you think is the biggest difference between Japanese and Western sweets?
Japanese sweets or wagashi tend to be simple and have a rather monotonous taste, particularly with confections meant for tea ceremonies. Complicated flavors are intentionally avoided so as not to distract from enjoying the tea. A lot of these sweets are designed to express the seasonality through the appearance and the texture. And each one tends to have a name that matches the season.
Right. Okay, but that's interesting that, you know, the Japanese wagashi kind of formed since sugar came in from China, and then tea ceremony developed at the same time. So the tea's bitterness, and like you said, that sweetness of wagashi complication should not interrupt tea ceremony's tea, so... That's very a Zen mindset. You have to focus, right? Okay, and as I said at the beginning of the show, an article about wagashi, including your amazing sweets, came out in New York Times Tea Magazine, issued on August 14th. And again, the title of the article is Sweets as Poignant as Poetry. One bite considers wagashi, Japanese tea ceremony treats as bittersweet pleasures for stressful times. Yes, definitely it's a stressful time, so we need a wagashi for sure. So what is the article about?
Article about? So, yes, they asked me to make a dozen or so kinds of wagashi. I wasn't given any details beforehand, but when I saw the spread, I was so excited because the photos paired the wagashi with these cutest cats. Anyway, that story illustrates the history of wagashi in such depths with information that even Japanese people may not be aware of. I was really impressed by it. I guess that's what the New York Times does indeed. I don't usually think of my work as making wagashi. Actually, I'm just trying to find new flavor that works with mochi. Also, naturally, I'd research and study wagashi every time I receive orders for orthodox wagashi for tea ceremony and for cafe. To be honest, I've become increasingly more intrigued by wagashi over the last 2 years. So when I received the order from Tea Magazine, I wasn't particularly thrilled about making traditional dessert at first. But I was familiar with many of the wagashi pieces they asked for, and they reminded me of my childhood in Kyoto. So while I was making the wagashi, I thought of a channel of my old self, and it turned out to be such a fun experience. Earlier, I talked about how innovating traditions is the theme for the thing that I do. But I think the fun part is the process of creating something by channeling the past and the future and memories and hopes. And I think that sort of process is particularly prevalent in cooking and food culture.
Right. Yeah, the Times Magazine article, I'm going to put the link to this article on this episode page, but it's basically classic wagashi in a, like you said, it's the prettiest and cutest cat. And its combination is so unusual, right, for Japanese people, like really like pink background. But I really think Times got the point of wagashi, which is traditional, but there is something appealing to everybody, right? And I really like the article because it really depicts wagashi so well. For instance, there is a paragraph to say, taste is only one of the senses these sweets seeks to address. The sound of the confection's names, the delicate scents, the textures between the teeth, crumbly, slippery, airy, dense, stretchy, the miniature landscapes they offer to the eye. And that is really true, that one piece of wagashi can be a flower or, you know, the mountain view summarized on one piece of the sweet. So, yeah, so I really recommend that all the listeners read this article. And there's a cute video of the article with the cats, too. Right. So, so where can we find your sweets?
So for now, you can find two kinds of our creation on Saturday and Sunday at the match cafe called Setsugeka in the East Village.
Okay.
Also, we do take private orders, so long as they are placed in advance. We make mochi at our Soho studio and prepare the order for the requested date and time.
So Setsugeka is S-E-T-S-U... G-K-K-A, Setsugeka. Okay, so the East Village. This is a cafe? Okay. Right, and I also heard, you know, the restaurant Kosaka, the sushi place, serves your dessert too?
Yeah, I've been. Okay. Yeah, served. But not now.
Okay, right. So that's the first time I tried your sweets. Wow, stunning. So that's really why. Yeah, that's Kosaka. Okay. And yeah, that's the Setsugeka on Saturday, you said?
Yeah, Saturday and Sunday.
Okay. Right. I'll be there this week. Okay. And so who are your clients?
So we get a lot of Asian American clients, but it's New York, so really they are diverse and different nationality.
So it's universally appealing to everybody. Yeah, I think another thing about wagashi, and including yours, it doesn't stay on your tongue, on your stomach too long. So it's kind of dangerously addictive,
mm-hmm.
but then you don't feel heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason wagashi is popular.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not a huge commitment. Mm-hmm. You can just enjoy lightly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you seem to have interesting activities outside of Mochirin as well. So, for instance, I heard that you had an interesting event in June last year with six other Japanese artists called Dinner, Wabi, and Nail. And what sort of event was it, and how did it happen?
Mm-hmm. It was a part of a tea ceremony event series called Wabi and Nail, which is organized by the ceramist Mr. Akihiro Nikaido in and outside of Japan. In 2015 and 2016, he had shows in New York.
Mm. He's a ceramic artist.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So each year he hosted a tea ceremony in conjunction with the shows. And I was given the opportunity to prepare the meals for the event. His bowls and plates are thin but hard and modern. And they have the stoicism and embodies the spirit of Zen and Wabi. His style is such that if Sen Rikyu were still alive, you'd imagine he'd order tea bowls from this ceramist.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so, Sen Rikyu, by the way, for listeners, he's really the god of tea ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. So we used Mr. Nikaido's ceramics to serve the kaiseki meals and his bowls to serve the tea. Flowers, too, were arranged in the vessel he made. Our purpose was to introduce the contemporary style of Wabi.
Mm.
I tried to express Zen and seasons blessing in my cooking too.
Mm.
It was a very fun experience.
Right. So are you planning to do something like that again?
Not yet. Maybe next year.
Okay. Yeah, if you do, let me know. I want to announce it on my show.
Thank you.
Okay. So, and where can we find you? Information online.
Mm-hmm. We have a website which is www.rin, that's rin-nyc.com.
Mm.
We are also on Instagram, and that's rin_nyc.
Mm. Okay.
Thank you.
So it's a beautiful website. So rin-nyc.com. I it's really stunning. And then
yeah,
probably,
thank you so much.
Yeah, so you can order your sweets too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, great. So thank you so much for joining us today, Ujiko.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing your sweets. Really, I loving sweets. I don't know what to say, but it's really stunning. So I'm so proud that you expanded the scope of wagashi.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes and Stitcher's podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I'm an engineer, David Tadasiore, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.